While Congress could not evict Obamacare, President Trump can start turning off the lights and the electricity. From Marketplace in New York, I'm David Brancaccio. Congress stayed up late, as did the whole crew at C-SPAN, and still, Obamacare remains in place. But President Trump indicated in a tweet this morning he's going to let the law, quote, implode, then do a deal. Joining us from our health desk at WHYY is Marketplace's Dan Gorenstein. Dan, how might the implosion be encouraged?
Well, there are a couple of levers President Trump can pull, David. Right off the bat, he could stop making payments to insurers that help cover out-of-pocket costs for consumers, things like co-pays and deductibles. This year, that's worth about $7 to $8 billion to insurers, money that helps bring more predictability to the market. If the president does cut that off, it's almost certain more insurers will drop out of the exchanges, and those left will jack up premiums.
Now, a hot issue is the law says everyone has to buy insurance or pay a penalty, yet this morning that requirement is still standing. Still, the president says he could do something about that?
Well, exactly. You know, one of the president's first acts in office was to sign an executive order sending a signal he may not enforce the penalty so he could direct federal agencies to lay off. This would pretty much have the same effect as not making those payments, chasing insurers away, and leading to higher premiums. Big picture, the Obama administration did 1,001 things to make sure people got signed up for insurance. If Trump takes a don't lift a finger approach, Obamacare probably won't implode, but it will definitely erode.
Dan, thank you. Now to the economy, which woke up from its winter hibernation, at least if you measure it by gross domestic product. There's news this morning. The economy April to June grew at an annual rate of 2.6% compared to 1.8% the quarter before. Chris Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial in New York, draws some wisdom from this. Good morning to you, Chris.
Good morning, David.
So spring into summer, a little better than that crummy winter we had.
Which seems to be the pattern going back the last 3 or 4 years. But it's not all wine and roses.
Well, this is what we like about you, Chris. You read deeper than these GDP headlines, and it resolves a bit of a mystery.
You know, in the data last year, as it was reported, we started to see some really decent income growth. On top of that, it was wage and salary growth. And yet, they were not spending that windfall. They were saving it. And it turns out the answer to the mystery, unfortunately, is that wage and salary income wasn't growing as fast as they thought. And because consumption stayed essentially the same, they also revised the savings numbers down. It turns out the savings rate was at a decade low. And I think it helps to explain why consumer sentiment seems to be having such a huge impact on the economy now. When people are feeling just a little bit upbeat, consumption will pick up. But boy, the slightest dark cloud and consumption tumbles. The reason is that income growth just stinks this deep into a recovery.
Christopher Lowe, chief economist at FTN Financial in New York. Thank you for this.
You're welcome, David.
This year, we've been focusing on what automation is doing for and doing to the American labor force. Forrester Research calculates that robots, algorithms, and automation will, on net, kill off 10 million jobs over the next 10 years. Today, though, a countervailing view. Here's Heidi Shierholz, director of policy at the nonpartisan but progressive think tank, the Economic Policy Institute. Welcome.
Thank you for having me.
So you and your team are not into this robots ate my job thing. It's not the problem. Why?
I am usually the most pessimistic person in the room, and I am not worried about the coming robot apocalypse. And the reason for that is that the footprints of automation being a problem are not showing up anywhere in the data.
Well, like what? You might be thinking, for instance, productivity.
Yeah. So productivity is where automation shows up in the data. And it used to take multiple people, many backbreaking hours to dig a ditch. Now it takes one person operating a hydraulic extractor. They can do it in an instant. So you can dig that same ditch in a lot less time. That's productivity growth. Over the last 10 years, we've seen remarkably weak productivity growth. In fact, we are at post-World War II lows with our productivity growth. So we are certainly not seeing a speed up of automation that might make someone concerned about automation displacing too many workers.
Now, no one knows you to be a Pollyanna person, and I know that you don't think that the labor force is in great shape. What should we then be worried about if not the technology threat?
It's a thing that we see over and over amongst economists, that they want to say that the trends we're seeing, like rising inequality, are actually a natural outgrowth of a modern economy due to something like automation or something else that is happening that we don't have control over. But really what we're seeing, what is causing our rising inequality, is deliberate policy choices, like allowing labor market standards to erode, like the minimum wage and overtime protections, seeing unionization fall.
Others would also add globalization done wrong.
Right. Another key factor in there is globalization that has prioritized corporate profits while consistently exposing our workers to fierce competition. Those are the things that are driving our stagnant wages, our rising inequality. It's not being caused by natural forces of automation.
So if Alexa or Siri start doing the Dow Jones Industrial Average and the NASDAQ every day and I lose my job to automation, I'm going to call you.
And I'll say, oh, there's another good job somewhere else for you.
Heidi Shierholz is a senior economist and director of policy at the Economic Policy Institute. Thank you so much for this.
Thank you. It's my pleasure.
Marketplace.org for my Robot Proof Jobs podcast series. In New York, I'm David Brancaccio with the Marketplace Morning Report from APM, American Public Media.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.